This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Hunter Cady is a young man in his early 20s who works at the front desk of a car rental agency. Perpetually unsure of himself, he lives with his parents in a bedroom his mother calls the shrine. Having spent much of his youth as a self-described extra in the movies of other people's lives, that is until Hunter meets Caitlin, a woman who listens when he speaks, and even when he thinks he's talking too much, Kate asks follow-up questions. Hunter and Kate are the central characters in Tom McAllister's first novel, The Young Widower's Handbook. And as you can guess by the title, the two marry, and then Hunter loses Kate to a sudden, untimely death, and immersed in misery, decides to escape the commotion caused by mourning by heading due west. The book is less a how-to on coping with such an enormous loss as it is a glimpse into one character's roller coaster ride through grief and the bizarre and at times very funny reality of a world which somehow still manages to exist without his partner. Tom McAllister is a Philly native and an assistant professor at Temple University, where he teaches creative writing. And he's also co-host of the Book Fight podcast. And Tom McAllister, it's so nice to have you here in studio with us for Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm glad that it worked out with my teaching schedule.
Yeah, well, so are we. Yeah. Before we get going, let's give the number out. So if folks want to join the conversation, they can do so. 888-477-9499 is the number. Or you can send us an email at Radio Times at WHYY.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So before we get to the story, you paint grief beautifully in this book, and you take us to some pretty dark places, even as humor kind of brightens many of the corners of this story. I'm interested in knowing, you know, as a young married man yourself, how did you come to explore such a really sad subject?
So it comes from, I think, two things. One is, so my father died when I was 20 and I was in college, and many people had much harder issues with their parents. But then about 6 months later, my wife and I have been dating since college. Her mom died also. And for both of us, it just became this really formative event in our lives. So it definitely changed our perspective on a lot of things, including kind of even when the idea of this book came up as we were on vacation for our anniversary, and we started talking about places we'd love to travel, and then one of us said, like, well, we better do it before one of us dies, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's just a thing that's been on our mind a lot, and you kind of – I mean, everyone's gone through losing a loved one, right? And it's this universal thing, but it's also so individually experienced, I think, that – so part of what I wanted to do is kind of just represent the sometimes – dark, sometimes really absurd things that come up, I think, after death, after the death of a loved one. And the other thing was, now, as I was writing the book, I would try to put myself in the mindset my wife would be at work, and I wrote a lot of this while I was on break from teaching, and so I'd be at home all day alone, and I'd just have to put myself in the mindset of, you know, what if she didn't come home today?
Yeah.
And some days it was, you could really work yourself into a pretty miserable state, but it was also, I think, necessary to try to really be sort of immersed in the worst feelings to try to get to the better stuff.
Yeah, I guess you have to go there.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, so tell us a little bit more about the main characters. I tried to sketch Hunter a little bit, but elaborate.
So Hunter is the first thing people always assume that it's very autobiographical.
Actually,
the first thing people ask is if my wife is alive. And I always tell them that, you know, like today I heard from her at 10:30. So as far as I know, things are good. But so people assume it's autobiographical. In a sort of way, there are aspects of Hunter that are, I think, were based on, I think, what I would be a worse version of myself. You know, there's a version of me in college who was pretty smart, but pretty unmotivated. A lot of teachers who seemed very frustrated that I wouldn't do more than what I had to do to get good grades, but I wouldn't pursue anything with much vigor. And actually, that kind of carried through for beyond undergrad for a little bit. And so it's sort of – and I thought of some of my friends in the same way, kind of bright but lazy, unmotivated people who can get by, you know, because they know how to write a good sentence or fake their way through a test or whatever. And so Hunter in a lot of ways is sort of an amalgamation of all those types of people who I knew a lot of. And the reason for that partly is because I think I could write that person's interior life well, but also because in addition to losing his wife now, he's in a place, he's 29 when it happens, he's in a place where he has to completely reinvent himself and figure out, who am I supposed to be now? He can't just default to say, I'm Kate's husband, I'm good at being a husband, now I have to be a person and I have to solve problems for myself. And so it's a lot about maturing and growing up, but it's just sort of this stunted growth, you know?
No, sure. And is Caitlin modeled after your wife?
Certain parts, like that she goes to bed very early. But no, there, in certain ways she is, in that my wife is probably the one most responsible for making me mature and kind of be a better person. But her actual individual characteristics are sort of based on a handful of other people I know, especially her family is this Northeast Philly family that is, I'd say, rough around the edges.
Raucous,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And they're based on the sort of people – I grew up in Roxborough, and they're based on a lot of the sort of people I knew, where there was always, like, I feel like one person in the family who does not love the neighborhood anywhere near us as much as the rest of their family does.
Yeah. All right. Well, so to get into the story a little bit more, Kate dies from complications of an ectopic pregnancy. And there's a real feeling of guilt here on Hunter's part. You write, Tom, of the suddenness of this character's death and then the moment when Hunter first sees the body. And if you could, I'd like you to read a passage from the book about that moment.
Sure. A nurse told Hunter he could see the body if he wanted to. Not only did he not want to, but it seemed like the worst possible thing anyone could do at that moment was to look at Kate's corpse, and so he said no, but still the nurse hooked him by the elbow and led him through a series of doors and curtains until he was standing over the body, and he swore he could see her breathing, not just the up-down of the chest, but the actual breath, as if they were outdoors in winter. He wanted to capture the breath in a jar and carry it with him, uncap the lid during times of crisis, and inhale her essence. He couldn't force himself to touch her, was afraid to move beyond the doorframe, and the nurse said she understood. It's very difficult to lose a loved one. Hunter nodded and said, please don't leave me. And the nurse, thinking he was talking to Kate, left.
Mm. It's a really sad moment and yet a little bit of almost sad humor.
Yes.
It just kind of sets the tone for the book. But what I wanted to know, Tom, was the line about capturing the breath in a jar. I thought was really beautiful. What goes into crafting a line like that? Did that just appear for you somehow as you're thinking about this story? Or did you really have to work to put those words together?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because like on first drafts on this sort of thing, you tend to go to a lot of cliches. I mean, grief has been written about and covered in a million different ways. And the first thing that at least I thought of as I was writing first drafts is the sort of things you would see in Hallmark cards and kind of very simple things that are familiar, but they don't carry much weight. And I tried a lot to try to, in later drafts, to sand those out first, but then also to try to think of more particular ways of dealing with it. And honestly, probably when I thought of it, is probably we were sitting outside in winter, and I was.
You could see breath.
Yeah. And I'm sure that I made a note in my phone and then made sure to run upstairs and type it later on. I think I teach creative writing students, and where a lot of students struggle sometimes is to get past that very familiar scene that they already know from an action movie or from whatever they're writing. And I think the way it's all in the particular details, where hopefully this is a detail that's very particular to this sort of weird, introverted young man.
Yeah. So in other words, you try to teach your students to be aware of moments that are happening and then try to capture those moments as opposed to looking at what has been written before.
Yeah, exactly. And what a lot of them find, especially if they're really investing in the work, is they find that they actually do have really unique perspectives on how things work. It's just that, without pushing yourself through the early drafts, you never get to those things. It's very easy. And there's a reason the cliches persist, because it's easy for us to fall back on those, especially in times of grief, right? That's the things everyone says to you at the funeral are, let me know if I can do anything. I'm so sorry. He was a good man, all that stuff, which is not bad, but it all blends into this one mass of words that don't mean a whole lot.
Well, while we're on that subject, you write of the commotion that happens in a house after someone dies. And one more paragraph for you to read, if you could. We'll get into that.
Sure. It says he uses the name Dixon's. That's Kate's maiden name.
Yeah.
His house is infested. There are coworkers and college friends, neighbors and ex-boyfriends, and there are so many Dixons, many of whom he has not seen since the wedding. They are streaming through his house, eating the sandwiches and fruit platters that seem to be delivered hourly, as if people think the problem isn't that Kate is dead, but simply that she is hungry. The doorbell never stops ringing because there are always more sandwiches and flowers to be delivered, and he feels obligated to tip every delivery man. And by the way, how are flowers supposed to make him feel better in any way? Hunter sits on the end of the couch while little nieces and nephews and cousins scramble underfoot and throw chunks of fruit at one another. Kate's aunts are sorting her belongings into various boxes, some marked donate and some marked keepers. And even though they are helping him, even though they are tying up loose ends, he is disturbed to see how easily a life can be categorized and boxed and bagged and disposed of, all of its loose ends tied up and all of its meanings suddenly stripped away.
Well, many of us who have experienced just this, wonder, is there perhaps a better way of being supportive to the loved ones left behind?
Right. It's so hard. And the one thing that I didn't want to happen in the book is for Hunter to be too self-pitying or complaining too much about people trying to help. He does do some of that. And he's definitely, especially early on when he's very much wrapped up in himself, and various characters try to pull him out of that. But it's very difficult because even people, all the people in that scene are trying their best. Like, this is the thing they know how to do.
And
this is
the thing they saw. And yet he's thinking the word infested.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty strong word.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just like, in my experience, it was like I wanted people around, but I also wanted nobody near me at all, you know, and it's completely unfair expectations. And I think at least the way that I've personally tried to approach it when I've had friends lose people is to just kind of show up, you know, especially a couple weeks later. Because I think there's this tendency for, you know, you're there, you're present, you send the sandwiches, you send the flowers, you send a card, and then a couple weeks later, the person's supposed to be better. And they're not better, you know, and it's going to take a while. And so I think...
it's the long haul.
Yeah, and just an occasional note just to say, like, hey, I'm here.
Yeah.
I think that carries a lot of weight.
Yeah. So the goodwill between Hunter and his family quickly evaporates, and he decides to take Kate or her ashes on a trip. And I'm not going to get too much into this story here. Just want to touch on a couple of things. Somehow you manage to stay in the realm of a grieving husband here with Hunter, carrying this canister into these adventures and encountering these off-the-wall characters. For instance, Hunter and Kate get sucked into a Renaissance fair in central Pennsylvania, encountering actors who are so into the narrative that they actually seem to believe they're part of it. You know, not again to spill too much of it, but Kate's cremains are in peril. It's really funny and at the same time kind of surreal. So what is the purpose here in combining tragedy and comedy?
I think they're naturally paired in so many ways where they're kind of two sides of the same coin. I'm definitely not saying anything new there. But also it was about balancing the tone where it would be a real slog to read 200 plus pages of a book where the person is just sad,
sure.
You know, and having these moments of levity, I think, kind of balances it out. But it's also, I think, very true where there are even moments, well, that particular moment, he's not forgetting about her, but there are moments where you're forgetting about the person and still just caught up in regular life.
Yeah. All right. We're talking to Thomas McAllister. He is the author of The Young Widower's Handbook. And we'll have more of our conversation in just a moment here on Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Again, if you'd like to join us, the number is 888-477-9499. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and our guest this hour is Tom McAllister. He is an assistant professor at Temple University. He is also an author, and his second book is his first novel. It's called The Young Widower's Handbook, and we're taking a look at the story today, and we're also talking about his life and his other jobs, too. You've got a lot of things going on, so we'll get to that, Tom. But first of all, we're talking about writing humor and how it fits into the story of tragedy. How do you write humor successfully, and what do you tell your students?
That's a good question. I think it took me a while to – I always wanted to be funny in writing, and it took a lot of failures. That dates back to reading, probably the first book I really loved was Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut when we read it as freshmen in high school, and I didn't realize you could be funny and also sad and all those other things at once. So that was probably a formative book. Also formative was anytime we went on vacation and had access to cable TV, was just watching stand-up comedy specials all day long. But I think that when we talk about humor in class, it's sometimes hard. Sometimes students want to write something funny, but it's not something that necessarily comes naturally to them. But I think the only way to really do it is to follow your instinct to the kind of the weirdest, strangest ideas you have. I have a friend named Dave Housley who's a writer who says he always tells people just to embrace the weirdness and get as weird as you can, which is not to say that there's like sci-fi elements, but just little lines where someone's willing to go beyond. I guess it's similar to writing about grief, where you're going beyond the familiar details into kind of a bizarre line or a bizarre interpretation of a pretty simple thing.
Or even just something that can be a little bizarre in an otherwise fairly normal scene. For instance, some of these characters that Hunter Katie encounters, you know, one has a bird named Elvis whose feathers have been gelled into a mohawk. I got a little chuckle out of that. It was kind of a goofy scene, you know, but that's just a little bit. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Like,
off the wall observation.
Yeah, it starts with it's Hunter and two other people having soup together, but there's something weird about the room, and it's partly that bird who just keeps shouting things that the one man doesn't want the bird to say. And so it's otherwise a normal interaction, and then there's this one element of that throws everything a little bit off its axis, which I think that keeps the reader on their toes a little bit, and it unsettles them from just the kind of the comfortable scene that maybe they were expecting.
So of all the wacky characters in this book, which is your favorite?
It's probably a bad answer if I say the bird, but I kind of love the bird.
I love the bird.
I mean, he's only there for a few pages, but I had so much fun writing it because that's exactly that scene. That scene turns out to be kind of sad, but that's exactly the sort of scene that I love writing, where it's making me laugh, but also I know my editor might come back and say, this is maybe too sad. We have to find a way to modulate it.
So when the editor does come back to you and say, you know, even if you love that line about maybe the bird he or she doesn't like it, how do you react? Gritted teeth? What is he thinking? Or do you go along with it? Do you have a little fight?
Very lucky. Yeah, so it depends on some. I'm very lucky. So my agent and my editor at Algonquin are both people who really know what they're doing, and they've both been around a long time and worked on a lot of great books. And more importantly, we have similar sensibilities. So most of the time when they came with an edit, I would have this vain reaction, right? So, you know, how could they dare mess with my words? But then I'd look and say, oh, that is better. There were a handful where we kind of went back and forth, and there were definitely some where I think the best thing an editor can do is save a writer from his or her worst instincts. And so there were some where I pushed probably too far on the things that were like very dark humor. So the interstitial chapters in here are pretty short second person things written sort of in a diary format, the handbook. And there was a couple of those where I pushed it so far that the editor said, I think we're going to lose too many people. we need to pull back a little bit. We don't want to necessarily have an uplifting, super happy ending, but we need to give people a glimmer of hope in here. And so they really helped me to balance that.
Yeah. All right. Well, so again, you are a Philly guy and who, like a lot of Philly people, now live in South Jersey. and in this book, there's a paragraph. A year into their marriage, Hunter decided he was done with Philadelphia and the whole East Coast. It was a place so unfriendly, so dysfunctional, so pathologically negative, he was convinced he was tainted by the atmosphere, a regional affective disorder that had exacerbated all of his worst qualities and stunted his personal growth. So how is Philadelphia as an author's muse, Tom?
I love Philadelphia, and when I'm gone for a long time, I miss it, but also, boy, some parts of it are very frustrating. That thing about the regional affective disorder came when a few of my friends happened to move here after grad school. We went to grad school in Iowa City, and they just happened to move here because it was cheaper than New York or D.C., and it was a place where writers could still live relatively cheaply. And one of them was particularly concerned that Philadelphia had somehow gotten into his blood and made him too angry and negative all the time. And so I definitely had him in mind as I was thinking about that. Say it can get to you. The 2 years I didn't live in Philadelphia, I remember distinctly being just very uncomfortable when strangers said hello. What are they up to? Why do they even need to make eye contact with me? And then I realized that's definitely my problem.
So you're back. So do you think you're going to, you and your wife might one day look elsewhere?
One place, I mean, for sure, one place that she would definitely live is Seattle, Pacific Northwest area, where I really loved when we vacationed there, too. The only thing that is definitely, the main thing that's held us back when we thought about it is family. You know, we're pretty close to our to both of our families, and they're all here. Sure. Her family's all South Jersey. My family's all in the Philly suburbs now. But, yeah, I think it's definitely on the table at some point to just, to detach from some of the negative elements that I feel like are in the atmosphere here some days.
Yeah. Any positives?
Oh, I love it. I love, you know, I sort of love the negativity. when there was the story about the hitchhiking robot that got destroyed.
Oh, yeah.
And some of my friends were so horrified, and it was felt like such a Philadelphia thing to me that I loved it, you know.
That was okay. That's the Philadelphia vibe that you're.
Yeah, you know, it's. I would miss complaining about it.
About the sports scene?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's half my conversations with, especially with strangers, are just complaining about the Eagles.
Well,
would I do without that?
We'll get to that in just a bit. Let's get back to the book for a moment and talk about. All right, tears and mourning after Kate's death. Hunter's character really wishes he could cry. And he tries to make himself cry. And at one point in the book, he does cry after he's been on, let's just say, an interesting bender at a sports bar. Why do you think it's so difficult to shed tears during enormous grief, even as it's almost expected that we do so? Because if we don't, then perhaps we didn't love that person enough.
Right. Yeah, that's what, for me, it felt like. Like I was almost like I was forcing myself into a performance. This is after my dad's death, you know, where I knew, I mean, I did feel sad. But I didn't seem to feel sad in the right way, or you know, I wanted people to see that I was feeling it in this way. I'm not a particularly emotionally expressive person. People who know me well could obviously tell that I was sad, but so there was this feeling of like, oh, I'm somehow even doing this wrong, and you know, I'm somehow failing the memory of this person by not falling to my knees and tearing my shirt and wailing.
Yeah.
And so that's where, you know, a lot of that with Hunter, where it's, you know, he feels all the things he's supposed to feel, but it doesn't feel like he's doing it in the right way. And that seems just like this insult on top of all the other injury.
Yeah. Which was more challenging for you, Tom, writing a memoir or a novel?
The novel and this is going to sound terrible, but when it comes to writing fiction, the thing that takes the most work for me is coming up with a good plot, you know, and making a plot coherent and move at a decent pace and be interesting throughout. Or the memoir, The Shape, was basically there because I was writing, you know, the shape of my life. I had to pick and choose the various elements I wrote about, but, you know, I had a clear endpoint. I had, you know, everything was there. In this one, the biggest challenge was I had the premise and I had the voice. I really was very happy with the sound of the voice and the rhythms of the language. But I got on the first draft, I got 100 pages in and said, he was in St. Louis and I didn't know what to do, you know, and then I had a lot to figure out from there. So that was of all the things, the biggest challenge for me is like trying to shape a plot that was worth reading.
So in that case, you know, when it gets to a certain point, you're not quite sure where to proceed. Do you hit the road because you know you want to travel and start looking around? I mean, what was the writing process like
for you? For me, this is definitely not what I'm recommending to my students, but the process is I just go online for hours and waste time, and then I avoid things and I watch movies. And you could make an argument that there's some process where there's a subconscious thing happening. The active process for me is avoidance, for sure.
Well, how long did it take you to write this novel?
it came in bits and pieces of over about a year and a half. And where when I was really into it, I can churn out words pretty quickly. When I'm actively, I feel good about what's happening. The other thing was, it was kind of talking to my wife. We've done a decent amount of traveling. So we'd say just like, I'd name a city and say, what do you remember from that city? And hopefully something would come up that I had forgotten about that can give me at least a destination to write toward. I ended up with probably, the Word document is about 70,000 words. I probably ended up with about 10,000 words of other travel things that happened that didn't work. But on days when I was stuck, it was, you know, let's put them in this place in Texas and see what happens and see hope it works. And then we'll figure out how to get them there. And some of them worked out really well, like the scene where he meets the bird, Elvis. He ends up in Chicago. And that was actually a very late addition. And some of them worked out a lot less well.
Yeah. So when you're teaching your students, and I'm assuming you're teaching them also that it's a long process. It can be a frustrating process. You're going to go to the left, but when you really want to go to the right, and but you just stick with it.
Yeah, and you know that's advice that I got repeatedly and completely ignored. When I was in graduate school, I was trying to work on a novel.
It.
Oh yeah, and all the best advice I ever got, I ignored or assumed that I was somehow that applies to other people, but not to me. And now I realize, now that I'm on the other side of that equation, I realize maybe that's the process. People have to get that advice and then fail anyway. And then
we're all
later,
kind of like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then later they say, oh, right. That was right. And so I try to, tell the students as honestly as I can about my own failures that the most I learned about writing was from writing failed novels and things that just never saw the light of day or fizzled out after 100 pages. And I had a professor in grad school who told me once that he has a drawer full of novels that he's never going to send out. And I, at the time, it sounded so depressing to me that you spent a year working on this book and no one's ever going to see it. And he said, well, it's just part of the process. It's going to be it's like the scaffolding I had to build to write the next book. That's going to be good.
So getting past the discouragement and hitching your ride to persistence really leads to success.
Yeah, yeah. And understanding that most of the writing is going to be bad in some way, or it's not going to be what you want it to be, not that it's going to be bad. And, there's stuff you can learn from that.
So do you have a routine? Do you get up in the morning and have a cup of coffee and then, say, okay, I'm going to write until 10 o'clock, have a snack, and then go for a run or anything along those lines?
Oh, that already sounds more ambitious than me. I do have sort of a routine. So I'm lucky my schedule with teaching allows me usually 1 to 2 days off a week where I'm just at home, where I can grade and stuff. But in the morning, I'm free to get up, have some coffee, I'll walk the dog, and then I'll write. On a good day, I will write till around lunchtime, and then I'll feel like I can call it a day. I'll feel pretty good about the day. It so rarely goes according to plan, but at least that's how it starts off most days. During breaks from teaching, definitely, I try to do 4 to 6 days a week like that. And then on weekends, I'll try to finish up. I'll try to, when my wife is doing her own schoolwork, I'll try to get my own stuff done.
Okay, Tom McAllister. So back to the book a little bit, The Young Widower's Handbook. At one point, the character Kate talks about reaching the age of 40 and if I'm remembering correctly, how it matters less what other people think of you when you reach that age. So if this character had lived, would they still be together? What would they be doing at 40?
That's a good question. Yeah. So
do you ever think about that stuff? Yeah. What would happen? Can you let your characters go after they're done, or do you keep thinking about them?
Sometimes actually in my classes, I give the students an assignment where they have to write the next page of a story that we've just finished. So they have to figure out what happens there. And so I've thought about it where in some ways, if he didn't find some other motivation to grow up and mature, it may not have gone all that well for them. After a while, she would get sick of waiting for him to put himself together. Maybe one would like to think that he'd find some other way to grow up, and it does happen. But it might also be kind of the sad reality of his situation that for him to become a better person, he had to be detached in the worst possible way from this from this person who he was relying on.
Well, and kind of as you're alluding to, in the adoration this character obviously feels for his wife, there's more than a glimmer of insecurity. And there's also this question: what happens when the joy of discovery gives way to comfortable complacency? And also, Hunter wonders whether he'd have been a good husband to Kate should she have become disabled in old age. I guess these are universal questions for anybody involved in a long-term partnership.
Yeah, that's, and I've known people, like a lot of people have, who have for one reason or another had to become the caretaker of their loved one, and it's heroic and admirable. And my first thought, like most people, is like, well, of course I would do that. And then I think, would I actually be strong enough to do that? I hope, but maybe not. Maybe I would actually be very bad at it, or maybe I'd be resentful. Or yeah. I mean, I think most people might have a mixture of all those things. Where it's trial and error. That's where I wanted him to, because he is immature, I think it's important that there are parts in the book where he seriously reflects on his own failure so that the reader knows that I know that he's immature, so that there's a clear sense that he's trying to get better.
Well, again, let's get on to some of the other work that you do. As a nonfiction editor, What are some of the more interesting offerings that come across your desk, Tom McAllister?
So I'm nonfiction editor at Barrel House Magazine. We're a literary magazine and small press. And the most common thing we get – so we have a thing where our pop, the nonfiction we get has to be somehow related in some way to pop culture. We stretch that sometimes to fit things. The most common thing we get is summer camp stories. I've read so many stories about – yeah, everybody seems to have an essay about – the time they lost their innocence at summer camp. And there are a handful of really good ones. David Sedaris has a great one, but there are a lot that are very similar. They all sound
the same.
It's a
little surreal.
Yeah. I never went to a summer camp. It seems like everybody did except for me, and they all have an essay about it. So we get a lot of that. And then we get a lot of stories. We actually did get an essay from someone while I was working on this book. It was an essay about her taking her husband's ashes on a road trip, and I thought, you're stealing my idea. and we ended up passing on the essay. It wasn't because of that. There was different reasons, but it was interesting. It sort of humbled me because I thought I had this brilliant, one-of-a-kind idea, and then there's just other people also doing it.
Yeah. Well, so when you what makes you turn a thumbs down to something that comes across your desk, and then how do you get that across to the writer?
So very often it comes down to this very subjective idea, admittedly subjective idea of urgency. The essays and stories that we take at Barrel House, and I think other editors will say the same thing, are stories and essays where it feels like the author urgently needs to say something, or it feels like they're putting something on the line there, especially in an essay, I really, the essays that kind of draw me in are, they'll be well-written and smart and all that, but there are lots of those. They're the ones where it seems like they're probably afraid of what will happen when their mom reads it.
More of our conversation with Tom McAllister in just a moment here on Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom is author of The Young Widower's Handbook. We'll talk some more about the book. And also, he's a sports fan, so we'll get a question in about that Super Bowl coming up here in just a moment again on WHYY in Philadelphia. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Tom McAllister, the author of The Young Widower's Handbook. He is also an assistant professor at Temple University. He teaches creative writing, and we've been talking about all sorts of things this hour. And also, I'd like to give the telephone number out. It's 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times as well. And Tom, just curious about what your wife thinks of this deep dive into the story of a young man who loses his wife.
Yeah, that's it. Some people think.
Has she read this?
She hasn't read the final draft yet. She read the early drafts. She's a much better copy editor than me because she's much more patient. And so she always reads kind of the final drafts before I send them out to people. She loves the idea. When we sort of came up with it together, talking about it, when we were talking about what would happen if I died before you, what would you do? And I probably made a joke. I would take your ashes on the road. And she said, that sounds like a book idea. And then we started immediately just writing. We were at dinner and she started immediately writing ideas down because it sounded like a book. She's very, very supportive of it. My family definitely likes to make jokes about, you know, the book where she's dead and things like that. But,
well, I was going to say, what are your friends? Because you're also young.
Yeah.
You know, what do your friends think about this conversation? It's really one that most people don't like to broach until, you know, or even want to broach until they're a little older.
Yeah, some people definitely think it's very morbid. So people who know us really well aren't surprised that it's a little morbid. We tend to both have that sort of sense of humor and sensibility. Where it's not uncommon for us to make jokes around those kinds of things. But definitely, especially people who know acquaintances who know us a little bit, they sort of look at you sideways and say, why don't you just think about happy things? Why aren't you writing a story about a loving couple traveling together and enjoying themselves? And, you know, but I'm drawn to this.
If you were to travel to New England, you'd find lots of happy people up there. And I have to say, so that's kind of an interesting segue into sports here. But you are a huge sports fan. And, of course, your memoir a number of years ago is called Bury Me in My Jersey, a memoir of my father, football, and Philly. So I have to confess that last night after Lady Gaga's halftime performance, I said, I'm done. I'm going upstairs to read. This is really depressing. And, of course, I was kicking myself as I woke up this morning, my husband and I both. So what did you think of that game? And is Tom Brady the greatest quarterback ever?
That's what I actually, my wife and I left the Super Bowl party we were at halftime because she had to get up early for work. And we said, well, you know, I'll watch the rest at home, but this game's over. We did say a few people in the room said, if anybody in the world can come back, it's Tom Brady and the Patriots. And I think, and of course they did. And I think the fact that nobody even doubted them when they said that is the best illustration of how great it's just this inevitable. You can't blow them out. You can barely beat them. And if you do beat them, it's going to come down to the last possible second, and it's going to take everything that you have. It's amazing. I hate them, but it is incredible.
It's
probably the most incredible run of sports dominance of my lifetime.
Sure. Well, and he is the greatest because no one else has won 5 Super Bowls.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and no matter the circumstances, they win differently every time. It's amazing.
All right. So as a Philly guy, Tom, one more quick sports question. So Doug Peterson and Carson Wentz, you think there's some hope for Eagles fans here?
I'm excited. Yeah.
All right.
I tend to fall into the trap, though. So, I mean, the first time I was on Radio Times was after the Phillies traded for Cliff Lea, and the whole point of the show was Philadelphia sports are entering a golden age, and then a year later, everything fell apart for everyone. So maybe I'm not the right guy to ask, but I think things look good on that front.
All right. Well, we'll take you at your word and kind of march forward with a sense of hope. All right. Back to the book for just another moment or so. So the characters Hunter and Kate both come from dysfunctional families, as we touched on a little earlier. Although Hunter's parents are still together, he calls them by their names, Jack and Willow. Jack is a no-nonsense tough guy. Willow's exploring, shall we say, a new age lifestyle. They seem to just be in vastly different places in their lives, and yet these two characters stay together. So
yeah.
Is there a reason?
I was thinking, I think where I first thought about that, well, partly because I wanted to have him have these different influences, and he's kind of pulled between these two worlds. But I know now, as I was writing this, I was in my late 20s as I started writing it. Now I'm in my mid-30s, and I know a lot of people who have children now. That's where that stage where a lot of friends have 1 to 3 children. And you can see it progressing differently for the different couples, where some of them maintain their independence as individuals and maintain an emphasis on a coupling as a relationship. And then there are other people who almost become strangers to each other who just happen to have this shared job of making sure this child grows up. And I wanted to kind of represent that, where Kate and Hunter had a very loving overall, there were some problems, but overall a very functional relationship. And I wanted to also represent this other version of these people who are together and they'll probably stay together until one of them is dead. But they barely know each other. They basically became strangers over time.
And yet Willow still deeply cares about her husband.
Yeah.
And she kind of talks about him to her son. Well, that's just the way he is.
Yeah, yeah. And there's that thing. It's like sort of a codependence thing. And it's also, yeah, it's still love, even though over the course of 40 years of knowing each other, they became vastly different people who would never interact now.
Yeah. Well, you also co-host a podcast called, Book Fight?
Correct, yeah.
Sounds kind of like a reality show book club discussion. Is that? I've never heard it, so yes. Tell us about it.
I can tell you, our equipment is a lot less nice than the setup here. We have no producers behind us. We started it. It's with my friend Mike Ingram, who's a writer and also a colleague at Temple. And we started it because, as sort of an alternative, probably to these kinds of discussions, not that there's anything wrong with these, Mike was listening to a lot of podcasts 5 years ago, and he said, I wish there was more literary podcasts that were a little less dry or academic. And he said, because he was listening to comedy podcasts and literary podcasts, and he wanted something that sort of bridged the gap there. Not that we're comedians by any means. And he talked to me about it. I had never listened to a podcast until he told me to in 2012. And we started, he assigned me homework, and we decided what we wanted it to be. The book conversations we enjoyed the most are the ones that are when we're in a bar with our friends and things sometimes go off on tangents, they get heated. We end up not disagreeing as much as you might think with that name, but we disagree on stuff and we kind of it's looser. And so we wanted to kind of provide that alternative to the, you know, not that there's anything wrong with the New Yorker podcast, but we wanted it to be something different basically because we couldn't compete with what they have.
Well, what sort of books do you discuss?
Oh, it's such a wide range. The most recent book we did was The Book of Lost Things by John Donnelly, which I had never heard of. Mike picked it. We alternate picks. And it's this weird fantasy novel about a kid in World War II England who ends up in this kind of fairy tale land where all the fairy tales are a lot sadder, like the Seven Dwarves are communists, are socialist activists who hate Snow White. There's a lot of the Goldilocks was just eaten by the bears because they were sick of her. And then it gets really dark. It was a great book. but then the week before that, what did we talk about the week before that? We'll shift from, we'll read Stephen King stuff, but then we'll talk about small press literary fiction. We'll talk about short stories.
So anything goes.
Yeah. Basically, it's just whatever I happen to be reading this week, Mike, you have to read it too.
Well, who do you like to read? Do you have anybody on your night table?
There's so many. The most recent book – actually, I was going to say the most recent book that we read for the show that I loved was actually the Book of Lost Things. Before that, the Marlon James novel, not the new one that has all the hype, the one before that, which is called The Book of Night Women, which is about a slave uprising in Jamaica. It was just incredible. It was a book I had never read Marlon James. I had never read anything about him. And then our guest, Asali Solomon, who's a we have sometimes have guests, and she's a Philadelphia writer. She said, "Here, read Marlon James's book," and I was just blown away. Just everything about it, the energy, the urgency.
What about the style of writing?
I tend toward books. The books that get me most excited are ones that have really great language. My brother and I strongly. My brother's a sci-fi guy, and I have nothing against sci-fi, but he wants plot. He's a reader who wants interesting plot and sciencey stuff, and I can tolerate a book where almost nothing happens if the language is just beautiful and interesting and surprising. Like there's an author named Jeff Dyer who writes books where almost nothing happens, but he's so smart, and I just love being around, kind of being in his head for a long time.
So with your students, what do you recommend they do if they're learning to write creatively? Just go out and read as many different authors as you can. And also, how do you then advise them not to crib somebody else's style, which would be easy, if you admire somebody's style.
Yeah. And that's really what a lot of young writers do is they basically just mimic. I know I have some friends who for assignments, they actually have students just literally rewrite what they're reading in some things, I think, have them get that feel of having that language. I don't do that, but what we do in addition to them writing, I'll assign a lot of stuff, and I try to assign a very diverse range of writers, which is diverse in style, but also in era. Like today we read a short story from 1965 by Stanley Elkin. Next class we'll read a story by Mary Gateskill that was published in the late 90s, but also definitely diverse by gender and race and things like that, just to, because most, even the most well-read college student has huge gaps in their reading on their shelf.
Why is that, do you think?
In my case, it was because I was playing a lot of video games. But
that'll do it.
Yeah, I think it's just because there's so much, and because like the high school classes they take tend to be very focused on a really narrow range of writings, and they're still assigning a lot of the same stuff they assigned when I was in high school, and probably a lot of the same stuff they assigned when you were in high school. Which is not bad. Those books are great.
Well, how would you change that, Tom?
I've thought about this a lot because I feel we get so many students who get to college, and not even just college students, but people who are burned out on books. They feel like the thing they got from English class was that they hate books, and there's got to be some way to connect with them. What some people do definitely is they assign things like The Hunger Games, and I don't have a problem with that exactly, but I would love to find – to use that and also to find literary – stuff with kind of maybe more literary merit that is also interesting and gets them excited.
Modern-day writers?
Yeah. George Saunders, I think, would be someone that high school students would love. George Saunders' book comes out the same day as mine. I shouldn't promote the competition. not that he
it's
needs
all right. There's
help.
Room for both. Yeah.
but someone like George Saunders, I didn't read till grad school, and I said, oh, my God, this guy's so fun. And I think that sometimes the way English classes go, and part of it, there's a lot of reasons why, but students don't realize that books can be fun, and there's certain things that we can probably do to make them more fun. And one thing I try to do to accomplish that is to just really share my enthusiasm. Like this Stanley Elkin story called A Poetics for Bullies. It's not like it's a rare story, but it's not widely anthologized. But in class, I was just so excited to talk about it because I was reading it again last night and I loved it so much. And I think it translates to most of the students if they see that you actually care and you're not just going through
sure.
the motions.
Yeah. Well, so if a student comes up to you and says, I want to be a writer, that's not your day job right off the bat, I'm sure,
right.
Unless you're absolutely brilliant right out of the gate. So how do you advise them? I mean, because you do a number of different things and you do your writing on the side.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's part of it is making space for it, for sure. Mm-hmm. When I got out of grad school, I don't think I wrote anything for a year. It was sort of like this burnout thing. And a lot of my classmates was the same thing. making space for it instead of making kind of pushing it off a lot. But also it's finding community. And I'm lucky to have, because I'd gone to the grad program, because I'm at Temple and I know all these other professors, I have good friends, and my friend Ed Mike Ingram, you know, I have people who can talk about books and I can bounce ideas off them. They can read my drafts. But so many people I meet at conferences, when we do conferences, they come partly because they don't know anybody else who they can talk to about books. And finding that community makes a huge difference, partly in exposing you to writers you never would have heard of, so you don't just read the same stuff, but also in just making you feel a little less lonely and feel like this isn't a crazy thing that I'm doing. I think that makes a huge difference.
You also blog, Tom McAllister, about finding an agent, finding the right agent, and you say you entered the process blindly.
I did.
And you were very picky. As a matter of fact, you write as if you were doing the agenting world a huge favor by offering them your manuscript.
Yeah, the story of my career all around is just a series of reminders that I'm not as special as I think I am, constantly kind of being reminded that there are 10,000 other people submitting the same stuff to the same people. That's where editing is a big help, to see that
sure.
If I have to take four essays and I have to choose from 100 that are all good, how do I pick? So with the agenting thing, I think – so that was actually – so I have a new agent since that one. Boring story. But I ended up with a new agent. And I went into a blind – that was around 2007 when I started. And there was some information. There's lots of books and there's lots of different web resources, a website called agentquery.com, which I used extensively to find stuff. And the numbers game is very, very daunting. I submitted to 40 agents the first time around, ended up with two people who were thinking about representing me, and went with the one, Catherine Boyle. And second time around, it was the same thing. I thought, I've got a book under my belt. I'll just be able, you know, again, they'll be waiting for me to show up. And no, it was the same. It took about 8 months of, you know, probably out 45 submissions to different agents. And even my current agent, Julie Bearer, kind of gave me a conditional rejection, where it was, well, you know, if you go back to this and do a lot of edits, come back to me and I'll give it a second read.
And again, you have to have a thick skin and a real sense of your mission.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to keep getting past the rejection.
Yeah, because people are waiting around every corner to discourage you. That's, I think, where community helps too, because they can pick you up on those days when you're feeling
community.
Very bad. And yeah, and you know, I have a pretty thick skin, but if you get 10 rejections in a week,
you wonder if it's any good.
Yeah.
Well, how do you really need an agent in this day and age?
It varies. So there are a lot of really good small presses, which I hope includes Barrel House, where we publish people who have no agent. But a lot of times publishers like Algonquin, who did this book, or a lot of the big publishers like Random House, most of the time won't be reading something without an agent. And so it sort of depends on your aspirations. Like, I have some friends who are thrilled to just publish weird little novellas with small presses they print 500 copies, and that's what they want. No agent necessary. But here I thought this book might have a bigger audience. So,
well, persistence paid off. Tom McAllister, it was a real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times today.
Oh, thank you.
Tom McAllister's debut novel is The Young Widower's Handbook, and he'll be appearing at the Barnes & Noble in downtown Philadelphia tomorrow night. That's February 7th at 7 o'clock. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.